Seen a man stand over a dead dog by the highway in a ditch. He's looking down, kind of puzzled, poking that dog with a stick. Got his car door flung open, he's standing out on Highway 31. Like if he stood there long enough, that dog get up and run. Man, it struck me kind of funny, seemed kind of funny, sir, to me. How at the end of every hard-earned day, people find some reason to believe. Oh, Mary Lou loved Johnny with a love mean and true. She said, baby, I'll work for you every day and bring my money home to you. One day up and left her, and ever since that, she waits down the end of that dirt road for young Johnny to come back. Man, it struck me kind of funny, seemed kind of funny, sir, to me. How at the end of every hard-earned day, people find some reason to believe. Take the baby to the river, Kyle William, they called him. They washed the baby in the water, take away a little Kyle's sins. In a whitewashed shotgun shack, an old man passes away. They take his body to the graveyard, and over him they pray. Lord, now won't you tell us what does it mean? Still at the end of every hard-earned day, people find some reason to believe. Congregation gathers down by the riverside. Preacher stands with a Bible, groom stands waiting for his bride. Congregation gone, the sun sets behind a weeping willow tree. Stands alone and watches the river rush on. So effortlessly, Lord, and he's wondering, where can his baby be? Still at the end of every hard-earned day, people find some reason to believe.
How you doing?
Well, good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Eastern Panhandle, independent. Quite independent, actually. Community Radio. Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio here in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. We've been broadcasting, pretty steadily, but somewhat irresolutely for, a couple of months now, getting everything up and going. And I'm more pleased with the technical setup that I have been. This is John Case, and you're listening to the warm-up here to the Winners and Losers radio program of late from Shepherd University, but now over here at our own little radio station right atop the Four Seasons bookstore right in the middle of Shepherdstown, West Virginia. And we got some cool shows coming up today. Right off the bat, we're going to have Occupy. I'm just calling it Occupy West Virginia or Occupy Epic. It's been Occupy ever since, several years ago, whenever that thing started. We had a whole bunch of people in the studio doing our thing. It changed composition over the years, and has morphed a bit, more than a bit, as we all have. And so I'm hoping that I'm expecting Patience Waite to come in here today. We're going to have a call in from an old colleague of mine, Carl Davidson, and who's the co-chair of the Committees of Correspondence for Democracy and Socialism. But he's worn a lot of hats over the years. And I first heard of him when he was the editor of The Guardian back in the U.S. version of The Guardian back in the late 60s, I guess. Yeah. Of course, he was a leader of the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, at the same time that I was involved with those folks. While he's calling, and we got Mike calling in right now, let's see what's going on. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hey, buddy. How you doing, man?
Echo.
You're hearing
Echo. Echo.
What?
She's on her way.
Oh, she's on her way.
Yeah.
Did you say that you're getting a bad reception right now?
It's a little bit of, it echoes at first and then it kind of chills.
Well, that's because I positioned it in the middle.
The one in the middle.
The one
in the middle.
All right.
The one in the middle. The middle one.
All right, man. Well, that's good. All right. It's good to hear your voice. How you doing, buddy?
I'm exhausted.
No. Not again.
I'm just having a hard time. When the weather changes, I have a hard time sleeping. It's just a thing with me. Always, last couple of years, pretty bad. So it affects me. Weather affects different people differently. And, it takes me a little while to get used to the changes in weather patterns. So as I get used to it, it'll get easier.
Well, one thing I know about you, buddy, is that is that you're not going to be able to fly south, I don't think.
No. I mean, I would consider it. Come on. I mean, it's it just reminds me of a silly joke a friend of mine used to do. He used to come up on stage and say a lot of things people don't know about me. First of all, let me start off by saying I can fly.
Yeah.
So I always thought that, he made it, the way he did the joke, he just made it very believable.
Oh, I can believe that. Yes.
It was incredibly well done and well placed. I'm not doing the back matter or the front matter of the bit any good. I'm not helping him, but it was so funny. This is, and I just real quick, not on a somber note, comedy lost another really, really just bright star. Smart guy, funny guy, nice guy. Kevin Meaney passed away suddenly.
Oh yeah.
Past week, yeah, he was something else. He was really just one of those guys.
My problem is I don't watch the Comedy Channel much And I don't know any of these guys, man. I don't know them. But I'm glad you're keeping track of them. These are your brothers in arms.
Yeah, this is not.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
I knew of him, and several of us did, from watching back in the day. And back in the day, it was a little bit different. You know, there's so much to choose from now, on television and on the internet with regards to what you're hit with in terms of stand-up, because, you know, stand-ups were notoriously now self-promoted. You see people like Jim Gaffigan and those types of folks releasing their iTunes,
right,
saying, you know, hey, I'm putting this out there, here it is, and people going and buying it direct.
Sure.
And that's not such a bad thing, but, you know, there certainly isn't the... It's not limited. You know, it's almost unlimited now. You know, unfiltered, unlimited access to really, really good quality stand-up.
You know, one of the great things that's happened, Mike, since I got my piece of software that allowed me to manage inputs and outputs,
is that
I can now adjust the mix so that your voice is coming on as strong as mine.
Oh, wow, that's outstanding.
Without having it sound like it's coming from the moon.
Well, a lot of folks out there who actually listen to this program probably have always assumed my voice was on the moon or something, or my brain was.
No, I think sometimes it was before we. I used to have to set the mix so low in order to avoid the what was we thought was the echo, but actually was delay.
Right.
You know, and that was part of the reason why, you know, your volume, you know, was always so low. But although it was a little weird, I think maybe our friend from Florida, Dr. Love Doctor, when she calls in, I think maybe she's calling in from Skype, actually. From a Skype account, you know. I think that's what she's doing. Might reduce one of the hops. You know, hoppity, 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 hoppity.
Hops or... Now, when you say hops, I think barley.
No, I mean, you know, packets, internet packets have to hop along, you know. Hop, hop, hop from router to router to router to router to finally find you.
Right, right.
You know,
making significant jumps and then making significant changes along the way.
Well, maybe. One would hope that the hop would not, you know, pollute the packet.
I think you have it right there. One would hope that would...
Well, now we have the merger of Time Warner and AT&T being contemplated here, so that...
Come on. Really? You know, AT&T just took over DirecTV, and I don't know that we're going to have DirecTV much longer.
They're looking for... They're being aggressive, I guess. Who knows? I mean, it's at that level... I don't even know how to calculate it.
I was really, you know, I think I explained this to you on the air before. We had a real problem with DirecTV, and I went online and eviscerated them.
I went to their
main website. I went to their main suggestion box. I found the number for the CEO's office, Tom White. I called him. I left a message with his assistant, and just shredded them. And that afternoon, they called and asked. You know, they said, "What? How can we help you fix this?" And I got to give them some credit. You know, that doesn't happen very often these days.
Hey, you remember the guy? Do you remember the guy who he got? He had a sort of brief period of celebrity, I think, when he wrote about how he had written a letter to McDonald's, you know, asking them why it was with his egg sandwich they gave, with his egg McMuffin, they gave him a packet of grape jelly with it. Okay. Yeah. And he kept asking, and they wouldn't answer him, right, you know. But he kept sending, you know, a year's worth of letters. I just don't understand. It seems like I don't know anybody that puts grape jelly on their egg McMuffin. Now, right. If they ordered a muffin without an egg, maybe they might. But then finally, what they did, they never answered his reply, but they send him cases and cases of grape jelly. All right, hold on. We got somebody calling in. At it. Hold on. Good morning. This is Epic Radio, and you're on the air.
Hi, John. Carl Davidson here.
Hi, Carl. God, it's good to talk to you, man. You know, I'm glad we're both still on this side of the grass, okay?
So how's Wild and Wonderful West Virginia today?
Well, Wild and Wonderful West Virginia is very weird politically, pal. First, let me just say, Carl Davidson, a compadre of mine from many, many years ago, all the way back to SDS, and I first heard of him when I was reading The Guardian. I think you were editing it at the time. Is that true?
I was an editor for
long
for
time,
about a year.
Oh no,
yeah, news editor, writer. I held a number of different positions there.
Yeah. Anyway, so you know, and then right now he's the coach, wearing many hats as usual, but I think he's also the co-chair. Unless I missed the last convention, you got unelected or something.
No, I'm retired.
Oh, you're retired.
I stepped aside for other folks.
I see. Okay. Well, past co-chair of the committees for correspondence for Democracy and Socialism, and anyway, Carl. So. Well, maybe start out. I know you were friends with
John,
Tom.
Can I say good morning to Carl?
Oh yes, this is Mike Diesel. You know, our co-host here in Shepherdstown, Carl, and a professional comedian. Except,
morning, Mike.
Good morning, sir. Thank you so much for calling our little shindig here. We appreciate it. Yes.
So anyway,
my pleasure.
Tom Hayden.
Yes.
Let's take a moment, and I know you knew him, you know, well, and maybe if you could say a little bit about his contribution.
Tom had, you know, a remarkable influence on a whole generation. You know, he was the main author of the Port Huron Statement, which, you know, formed SDS, broke away from a small social democratic organization called the League of Death for Industrial Democracy, and eventually it evolved largely through his initial leadership into the largest student organization in American history. We had about 100,000 members at our peak.
Right.
It eventually fell apart, but that wasn't his doing.
No.
he continued on from his initial work as a community organizer to become an anti-war leader. And then when he hooked up with Jane Fonda, they did the Indochina Peace Campaign and did a lot of GI coffee house work. And then eventually he got himself elected to the California Senate.
That's right.
Then he and I got together later to set up Progressives for Obama, and we did some work there.
Right.
I think the most important thing, I mean, Tom was always a controversial figure on the left because he was willing to color outside the lines and break certain taboos, like running as a Democrat or crying at Bobby Kennedy's casket. But I think the reason he and I got along is that I understood him and he understood me. I told him once that the reason I thought we got along is because I knew he was never really a Marxist. He was a very consistent, radical, small D Democrat.
Yeah.
A left populist deep in the American grain, and he was very good at it. And he laughed and agreed, thanked me and agreed.
Right.
And said that I was one of the hardline Marxists that he got along with because I saw that the future was open and I was willing to get outside the lines too and come up with new theories and new conceptions.
But you always had an affection for philosophy, as I recall.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
And helps. Right?
We were both raised Catholic, so that always had some connection. But
you know.
But I had admired Tom from early on, and if it wasn't for him and others like him, I would probably have not been inspired to do a number of the things that I did, like going in deep into the civil rights battles in the South in the 1960s and carrying on in the, I've probably
right.
carried on in the anti-war movement in any case, but Tom was always a kind of compass, and that they agree with him or not, he raised always raised interesting questions. So
I remember the only time I actually met him was he had come to see Dave Dellinger, who was living in Peacham, Vermont, retired to Peacham, Vermont. And we had a big conflict going on in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, with a UE-represented shop called, what was it called? Fairbanks Scales, Thaddeus Fairbanks Scales, you know.
Well, Dellinger and I had actually the first time I actually physically met Tom Maiden was he, Dellinger, and I were at the Cultural Congress of Havana, and we got a call late one night to be whisked off to a meeting with Fidel Castro.
Oh,
and
wow.
We sat around and talked to Fidel for a couple hours late into the night.
See, wow. That was a great opportunity. I know.
It sure was.
Wow. Hey, guys, I'm gonna let you, John, I'm going to jump off of here, and your much, much, much better
co-host is on
the
way.
Much more attractive, much smarter co-host will be there in a minute.
All right, Mike. Take care, man. Yeah.
Okay, bye-bye. Guys.
Bye. Bye-bye. Anyway, so one of the things I wanted to, you know, open up with here this morning, Carl, was there's been a lot of talk. Here comes Patience, my buddy. Patience Waite, she's a, you know, when legislators see her coming, they sometimes turn and run the other way.
Sounds like somebody to have on your side.
Yeah, she's been very effective in the state. She has a cohort named Karen Newman as well that they've been the if you're a utility company and then they see you coming, you better think about cutting your rates rather than raising them. So anyway, but I wanted to talk a little bit about this aspect of the Trump phenomenon. I guess it goes earlier than Trump if you dig into there you go. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Now you can hear, right? Okay. Good morning, Patience.
Good morning, John.
We have Carl Davidson on the phone. You know, you're from Pittsburgh. Calling from Pittsburgh today, Carl?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, just north of Pittsburgh. Yeah. My hometown's Elk River.
Right. And well, anyway, so I wanted to open up with this question of when we use the word. Everybody I know has at one point in time recently used the, and this includes a Republican I know. You have used the word fascist in connection with something about Donald Trump, and they don't always mention the same attribute of his campaign or his supporters, but somehow it gets around to that term. Haven't seen this since Hitler kind of remarks, right?
They
now,
may not know the right definitions, but
yeah. But
they can smell it.
Yeah, it doesn't look right. So I mean, I know you've been writing some on this too, and I've seen some of your stuff, and so I'm going to ask you to sort of open up and give your thoughts. How close is this? I mean, what's the real threat here, and what does it say about where we're at in this country right now?
Well, I think Trump is an interesting character. You know, one thing, interesting question to ask about whether Trump is a fascist or not is to ask, when did Hitler become a fascist?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he too evolved over time. I always tell some people who are very dogmatic about this and they try to hold up the exact definition of what Hitler or Mussolini did as the definitive definition of fascism. And since Trump isn't that, he said it's wrong to call him a fascist. I said, well, if you use that standard, nobody's ever going to be a fascist again, because history never completely repeats itself.
Right.
And fascism, like everything else, evolves over time. And just as every left victory or socialist victory broke the mold of the ones that went before it, the same is true of fascism. It evolves.
Right.
I think Trump, to understand Trump, you really have to understand the phenomenon of right-wing populism in America. And that's what he runs on, as a right-wing populist. And that's what draws the crowds, because there's a social basis for it in our country at the moment. And even if it wasn't Trump, somebody else could run on it and win considerable support as well. But that's not the end of it, because within right-wing populism, there's a fascist snare, and there is a tiny fascist organizations in the United States. some of them grouped around, you know, his new one of his campaign people,
yeah.
Breitbart, from Breitbart.
Right. Yeah.
But the way it is to listen carefully to what Trump says he wants to do if he would win, and you know, the first thing he built his big base on was immigration and how he's going
right.
to promise to deport some 11 million people.
Right.
And you know, so think about that. What would it take to deport 11 million people? He talked about, you know, a deportation force as something that was beyond the abilities of the normal police and immigration services. And that if you think of what it would take to, you know, round up, detain, and then deport some 11 million people, the main thing to understand is that it wouldn't happen without resistance. There would be considerable
right.
resistance to it. And then to put down that resistance, it would take extra legal measures and violence. And therein lies the fascist danger. In order to implement some of the things he would promise, he would have to go beyond the limits of, you know, regular democracy, bourgeois democracy, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And use terrorist and militaristic means. And you could see it, some of the groups that are, you know, coming around him now, some of these militia groups that are based in Georgia and North Carolina that
yeah.
are going and serving as so-called border guards down in Arizona and New Mexico.
Yeah.
And then you had these, you know, these three guys the FBI just busted out in Kansas.
That's right.
For attempting to blow up a small mosque and some living centers for Somali immigrants in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the fascist danger arises. It arises within the right-wing populist movement as a trend and a danger.
That's the way I look at it. I was thinking about this the other day, and it occurred to me that there might be a flip side danger to this as well. For example, suppose you hold on, I got a mix is weird here. Suppose you were going to repress the fascist tendency. In other words, you know, because it's right now holding up any congressional action on a whole range of questions. It's paralyzing the country in some respects. I mean, the whole this right wing thing. So, but suppose you go out and you know, disarm some of these folks and you know, shut down some of the extremist stuff. I mean, then you could end up in a you know, you can end up abandoning democracy just trying to put the fascist threat down. You know what I mean? There's dangers
absolutely.
In both directions. You know, so
it's a symbiotic relationship to a certain extent. That's why I argue with some people on the left that it's not a good idea to try to shut down speeches by right wingers, even if they're taking the very reactionary line. The best way to deal with reactionary speech is to mobilize progressive speech, because once you start abandoning certain fundamental civil liberties, it could very easily have the tables turned against you.
Right. I mean, I was listening to a chilling NPR story the other day, I think, from it was about one of the participants in the Iraqi attempt to take over Mosul, right, from ISIS. And they were talking to one of the soldiers, or one of the new recruits who was, you know, part of the effort. And there had just been some announcement that, okay, we're going to take this, but then we're going to provide for taking care of the people, you know, that the civilians, et cetera, and all these other folks. And they were they had just been through a big meeting about that. And that this soldier came out and they asked him about it, and he said, well, no, actually, I personally intend to slaughter them all. You know, and they are, you know, that he'd obviously suffered the fatalities in his own family, you know, from the chaos and
right.
the sectarianism, et cetera. And it didn't matter to him, you know, whether he lost his own life in the process or not.
She ever Sunni thing goes deep.
Well, I don't know whether it was just that or just personal revenge, or you know, your family gets wiped out. You know, you want to take them all out. So
believe that anybody who stayed in Mosul.
Right.
Must in some fashion
collaborated.
Have collaborated.
Right. And so I'm going to kill them, their brother, their sister, their mother, their father, their children. Okay. And because I've just, and he says, we have decided we have to kill them all.
Now, well, you know, you don't have to go to Iraq. You know,
yeah.
You go to our own history. When the Smith Act was first passed, it was used against some 22 Germans that they had indicted for being sympathetic or spies to the Nazis and put them on trial. That was what the Smith Act was supposedly designed for. That trial turned into a farce, and eventually all those Nazis got off. But within just a couple of years, it was turned against the Trotskyists, I should say, Socialist Workers Party, and then against the Communist Party.
Yep.
So that is at the same time, they had the internment of the Japanese Americans and so on. So we don't have to go too far abroad to find these problems and these conflicts and contradictions.
Well, let me ask. This is a question that came to me recently. Was there fascism before Hitler and Mussolini? Is that
no, not really. Fascism rose mainly as a response.
To the Treaty of Versailles.
To modernization as a reaction, as a response to, you know, the problems of alienation and the suffering mm-hmm. under the Industrial Revolution and the defeat in war
mm-hmm.
And the wounded national sentiments because of, the defeat of Italy and the defeat of, Germany in mm-hmm. World War I.
Right.
So it arose in those conditions. So... And before then, I mean, you could talk about the slave South in the United States as a kind of fascism.
Okay.
And during the Civil War and the antebellum years as well. So there's always been harsh anti-democratic rule by terror
mm-hmm.
Throughout the history of government, going back as far as you want to go. But the nature of it is being a mass movement and a revolution against democracy.
Okay.
That doesn't come until the 20th century.
In Germany and I don't know about as much in Italy what the particular fascist coalition, but in Germany it definitely included the biggest part of the industrial capitalist grouping around Krupp and those guys.
The military were among and it was
earliest because they were. They didn't think democracy was getting them anywhere.
No.
But that doesn't mean they didn't actually create the movement. The movement was sort of spontaneously there out of the contradictions that you're like talking about. But then someone decided to think they could use
to pull
it.
Pull them together.
Yeah, to use it and as a.
Yeah, Hitler's first attempt at a putsch failed.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was a movement. That was a sort of movement of the unemployed soldiers. Largely, that was his base, but a number of officers in the German army supported him. And then once he got released, and the conditions under the Weimar Republic became more desperate, more and more the wealthy people got behind him.
Right. Well, you know. So I mean, now
of course they got behind him in the way that, to some extent, there are wealthy people in the United States getting behind Trump. It's not that they agree with him per se, but they see him as a useful idiot for
35%
corralling, of the population. Yeah, corralling the energy of...
Yeah, for breaking the back of the communist and social democratic parties.
Right.
That's what they saw, and that's what they wanted him to do.
And the unions, was the same thing, you know. Now, going back to Trump here. So Trump... Let's just take Trump out of the equation for a second, and personally, and look at this 35%
on the ground.
30 to 35% of the people, voters anyway, that are out there apparently passionate about this and agitated, and now let all this open racism, misogyny, god awful, weirdo stuff out of the bottle, and. Now, suppose you're a billionaire, just like Mr. Krupp there in Germany, and you think, here's a thing I think I can manipulate. And I don't have any love for democracy myself. I let all those poor people vote. First thing they're going to do is tax me, and we know that's just terrible. Right? So they, that's the problem with letting this crap out of the bottle, right? Is that now you know, people are going to see, bad people are going to see opportunities.
Right. Most of the wealthy people who back Hitler live to regret it. Speer was this big guy who was tried at Nuremberg, and Speer was the only one who pled guilty.
Right.
He ended up not being hung, but they gave him 12 years in prison. He was a top industrialist and banker that was one of them that carried out Hitler's bidding, but lived to regret it.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you were referring to Speer, Hitler's architect.
Yeah, that's
the same
guy.
Oh, same. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. So
he ran Hitler's defense industries.
Okay. So who was it that they kept in prison until he died?
Oh, I forget who that was. I know Speer eventually got out.
You mean one of the?
Yeah, Speer wrote a book.
One of the SS types, or
I can't remember
the fate of all of them. A lot of them, well, some of them committed suicide.
Right.
So if. I mean, but that's my question is do you, I mean, this kind of movement, for example, let's talk about austerity for a minute. And it's because that's a common theme also between now and the last time a fascist movement rose. There's a certain correlation. Because I think that the fact that there has not been a real real increase in median income since about 1972 that amounts to spit.
Right, it's been flat.
Flat, or there was a little bump under Clinton, although most of that turned out to be increase in household income, not actually personal income, okay? More people in the family working at better, a little bit better jobs. But still, so you don't get a raise for 2.5 generations. Let's look at it that way for a minute. And a lot of people take big cuts, and the country turns from manufacturing to almost overwhelmingly services, it looks like, is going to be, no matter if manufacturing comes back, it's going to be pretty high-tech, automated. I don't see any stop in that trend. And so here we are with a different economy, really, a very different economy than existed even in the 60s and certainly than existed in the 30s. But nonetheless, people have been going for a long time without any raise, and that drives people nuts, I think. I think it just...
Right. You know. But here's the thing. Those conditions apply, and they... You could... You know, out here in where I am in Beaver County, that people responded in two ways. Some of them are... Most of them are... A good number of them are for Trump, even union members. But on the other hand, a good number of them are for Bernie.
Yeah.
For the same economic reasons. Usually they're younger people who the precariat is more stressed out economically.
Mm-hmm.
Go for Bernie. So what's the difference between the two? It's not that they have different economic conditions. The same economic conditions fuel the left as much as they fuel the right.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is in questions of identity, is what I would think. I call it the white male entitlement disorder.
So do we.
Yeah, right. Okay. Speaking as the women of the world.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
It's been collapsing over the years, and as a result, Trump, just like Hitler, knew how to appeal to wounded national sentiments of defeat and war. That's exactly what Trump does when he says, we don't do good deals anymore. We don't win anymore. And then with the immigrants and the Muslims and all that, he appeals to the question of threatened identity. You know, that the country's becoming more multicultural. Probably in about 20 or 30 years, the so-called white majority will become the white minority. Me, I'm not one who even believes there is such a thing as a white race, but a lot of people think there is one and they're in it, and that sort of traps them in an identity situation that often runs contrary to their class interests.
I wonder if in some legislature we put forward a bill that suggested that we remove race from all the forms you have to fill out, or just add an additional entry, human. And you can check that if you want.
Well, yeah. you had the forerunner of that down where you are, a guy named John Brown.
You know? Well, but I think that I understand what you all are driving at. But at the same time, part of it is because the policies of government over the past 20, 30, 40 years have been driven by what, in this case, you'd say the elites want.
Right.
And I see this election, because of Bernie and his popularity, because of Trump and his popularity, I see this as kind of a wake-up call for the incoming administration and the incoming Congress, right, that when they consider, you know, they have not been considering legislation and policies to address the crises facing the middle class.
Right.
So I don't, you know, when we talk about these pressures and we talk about these feelings and everything else, I understand all that. You know, I see why people are so upset.
Yeah.
So, you know, particularly white men. Understand it. Now, I can't do much about the politics of resentment. I'm sorry. You don't get to sit at the top of the heap forever.
Okay.
You had a nice long run. But a lot of the anger would be ameliorated if there were policies going forward that were aiming at easing those conditions.
Right.
Whether it's raising the minimum wage and setting it up so that there is a permanent mechanism, like tying it to the CPI,
yeah,
so that it continues to ratchet up as costs increase. I mean, that's one example. But doing something about the cost of college, you're told over and over and over again, you've got to have a college education to get ahead, so you do something about the cost of college. If the administration and the Congress, beginning in 2017, try to pursue policies, is that enough of a safety valve? Will that release enough pressure that some of these things that Drumpf has exposed will die down or be ameliorated in some way?
Well, here's a thought experiment. Suppose the U.S. government adopted the same policies as Germany. I think, you know, that would address to a considerable degree, like every German young person goes to college for free. Mm-hmm. In fact, they even give them stipends. Or if they don't go to college, they go to various technical institutes and so on. And they have, you know, nearly guaranteed employment after they come out.
Right.
A strong social safety net and so on. So it's not like it can't be done under capitalism. Germany does it every day of the week.
Yeah.
And if we had the same, and they, you know, they have national single-payer health care and all of that. But if we did the same thing here, capitalism would still survive, and it would, you know, answer a lot of the pressing immediate concerns of the working class. But even in Germany, you still have this right-wing populism rising. It's rising in every country in Europe and the United States. So Trumpism is really an international phenomenon.
Yeah, that's true.
In fact, you could even make the argument that Putin in the Soviet Union is the head honcho.
Yeah, he's leading Let's Go Backwards. The Let's Go Backwards track, yeah.
So anyway, you can see all that. You can see that it's a global phenomenon. It's really a response to globalization. And
yes,
the contradictions therein.
Absolutely.
And some of the problems that you mentioned, John, the fact that certain jobs are gone for good, as much as Trump talks about bringing the old smokestack industry jobs back, he's not going to do it. The jobs of the future have to come, I think, more out of Hillary's program than his.
Sure, infrastructure stuff.
So, you know, it's really important, I think, to put it in a global context and see, that the right-wing populist is really emerging in every advanced industrial society.
Did you, patience, were you?
Oh. No, I was thinking of coal.
Oh, no. Well, coal. Yeah, that's a good example. Well,
right.
Here's
the real reason why coal is in trouble is because natural gas is so cheap.
Yes.
You know, but it has nothing to do with Obama's anti-coal policies, or and it won't change because Trump digs coal.
No, but they would. But and I think, in their heart of hearts, coal supporters, because it's not just miners. There aren't very many of them left. You know, coal supporters in West Virginia. I think in their heart of hearts they know that, but they would rather be lied to, knowingly lied to, than accept that they have to change.
Well, let me pose this for example, in the 1960s, the struggle for equality took place in the context in which actual median incomes were still rising. And they had that, they were colored a little bit by that quality as that, you know, everybody was getting a piece of the pie except for African Americans. And who said, what about us in a certain economic sense? And that struggle for equality sort of had a lot of dimensions to it, but it certainly took place in that kind of context. But now you have a long sustained period of austerity in which the struggle for equality is you know, also because these divisions have not gotten that much better, even though segregation ended, okay, at least a lot of it. So the struggle for, you know, equity right now in a situation in which growth is very slow. You've thought about that one. When you think about that, that's a tougher battle than when everything's going up.
Well, it doesn't have to be very slow. I mean, it's very slow for certain reasons, you know. There's a
you think
need,
so?
A crying need for a Green New Deal. Hillary offers, you know, most of it. If you read her economic platform carefully,
yeah,
we can put just by building a smart grid and all the infrastructure for wind, solar, and whatnot, we could put millions of people to work at decent wages at all levels, high tech, medium tech, and low skilled workers could all be put to work. But it would take something. It would take a Green New Deal on the order of what FDR did, and then some.
Patience is a critic of.
There's no real reason it can't be done, besides the fact that we got this so right wing Freedom Caucus in the House, and if we could smash it and get rid of it, the country could move forward.
Right, it's that smashing part that's.
But that's the task before us. You know, we have to find ways to mobilize a progressive majority and give it some political clout. Hillary, I think tactically, I would, you know, support her for a number of reasons, any number of reasons against Donald Trump.
Yeah, sure.
But I think that the real solution lies in the platform. It's not like the Congress doesn't know about these things. All the bills are there. Bernie's got his bills. Progressive Caucus has its bills. They're all there. They're just sitting there because, you know, we can't get enough people behind them. We can get maybe 100 people behind them, but it takes more than that to win them. So we really got to develop the organizational and political clout to move forward.
Hey, do you think that Senate might go?
I think so. I mean, according to, you know, it's hard to tell. I mean,
right.
This race has so many wild cards in it, you know. I mean, even though there's only 2 weeks to go and it looks like Hillary has an edge, there's wild cards that I know about that are scandals around Bill Clinton that haven't come to the surface yet. and any number of other things that could, you know, another huge World Trade Center type attack, or there's any number of things that can happen in 2 weeks to flip it. So I'm not letting up one bit, even though at this point it seems that Hillary has the edge. We have to make sure, you know, all the way to the finish line that we, you know, keep our shoulders to the wheel to make sure that Trump does not occupy the White House. That would be an utter disaster.
Yeah.
Now, Hillary, I think that, you know, one of the right-wing commentators on the Morning Joe made an astute comment. He said, or I think it was Joe himself, said that Hillary was not really a progressive. She was a new Democrat, neocon, a centrist, and he was exactly right. That's what she is. And you know, we're mobilizing a progressive coalition and center forces and even some Republican forces to try to get her elected. I know very well who she is. I understand Hillary completely, and she's not going to do everything that needs to be done. We're going to have to continue to mobilize, continue to win down ballot elections in order to get the kind of Congress that we need to pass a Green New Deal.
All right, let me patience. Go ahead.
I understand everything that you're saying. I understand, but when you brought up like modernizing the grid, I wanted to go back to it because it ties into another point. First of all, a lot of the talk that you've heard about modernizing the grid for renewables is hooey.
That's a Massachusetts term.
Hooey. Yes.
In this way,
and it ties to the larger point. You know, we have talked in the past about, like, you know, we've got big coal.
Yeah.
You know, we have all of these big interests, you know, big tobacco, big coal, big pharma, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear about things like modernizing the grid, what you are missing is that there is corporate interests, corporate money, that aspire to become big wind and big solar.
Sure.
They're
right.
Not interested in actually looking at what is the most effective way to do this. They're simply interested in knocking off big coal, for instance, and taking over.
Right.
So where I have a problem when we talk about things like that is the structural flaws in our current capitalist system. We're not talking about making changes to those, because there's always another corporation, always another industry that wants to continue the same framework. They simply want to be the ones running it instead of the ones who are running it now. And that's a much more fundamental issue. For instance, when you talk about you know, modernizing the grid. If you want to modernize the grid, you know what you do? You take the transmission lines that are already in place and you rebuild them. You don't need to expand it appreciably. You don't need to seize thousands or hundreds of thousands of acres of more land and create new rights of way and all that kind of stuff. We had a project here, and you know, now we're coming into my sweet spot, as John knows. We had a project here. They wanted to build this massive transmission line that was going to run from down near Charleston, ultimately, not initially, but in their big plan, ultimately all the way to New Jersey, so that they could basically ship coal by wire. They would burn the coal in West Virginia, generate the electricity in West Virginia, but ship it up to New Jersey. And what killed the project, ultimately, I mean, I'd like to think that it's all the activists who got together and the way that we mobilized and all that kind of stuff. No. What killed it, they had built their claim that the grid needed this new transmission line for reliability. No mention of how they want to sell, you know, coal-fired electricity to New Jersey. They want, you know, this is all about reliability. Well, what killed it was that a different utility company said, we need to rebuild this transmission line over here because we're beginning to have structural problems with the towers. And as soon as that line was rebuilt, all the reliability need that the original project had tried to claim went away. So, and it was like, oh, I don't know, 70%, 80% cheaper. So my concern when you talk about things like this, and this is just one little example because I know something about it, but when right. you talk about these kinds of infrastructure projects, you need to look at what is doing something that actually needs to be done, and what is doing something simply for the sake of spending money and throwing a sop to the public, but continuing...
Well, or to some particular constituency.
Or to some constituency, but in the meantime, continuing to build on the fundamental flaws that we have in our current system.
Let me ask this, you Carl, because I know this is a subject you're interested in, one aspect of it. Is how do you value the production of intangible goods and public goods. How do you distinguish, other than, you know, this laborious legislative thing, between the bridge to nowhere and the bridge that was built that connected St. Paul and Minneapolis, okay, in terms of their economic value?
Until it fell down.
Well, but I mean, it generated generations of economic value that you can't even count, okay? Well, my wife would argue, she's an economist, she'd say, well, you could kind of count it, but but we don't. The point is, we just, all public goods are valued at their cost of production, period, okay, right now in national accounts. And yeah. Well, not even market rate. No, there is no market rate for a public good.
You can't really, there's certain things that the intangibles you're talking about can't really be measured in terms of ordinary economics.
Because they can be stolen, right?
Because
and copied.
They use all these fudge factors, like, what do they call it? When your waste production, your waste products.
Oh, externalities.
Externalities. There is no such thing as an externality.
Well, actually, the other view is, Carl, is that there's nothing but externalities.
Right. My point is that all economic systems, socialist, capitalist, whatever, are subsets of an ecosystem.
Yes.
That's the truth of the matter. And that you can ignore, the laws of nature, and just continue to dump externalities willy-nilly as you please. But sooner or later, you're going to pay for it. It's going to come
back
at
you. But don't you know
there's a kind of karma involved.
No, Carl, that can't be so. There's no such thing as climate change.
Well, listen, Carl.
It's all a hoax by the Chinese.
Exactly.
We're cleaning our clocks on the green energy technology at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about the smart grid is not that we need new wires so much. The thing about the current grid is that electricity flows from the center out. It all goes in one direction. The thing about a smart grid is that it's a two-way street.
Right.
The electricity goes one way, but information comes back the other way, so that every electric meter on every home is a two-way thing. It not only counts electricity coming in, you can adjust your own use of electrical power. It becomes part of the internet, and you can adjust your own use of electrical power to the lowest times of day.
Right.
You'll get the lowest cost.
Yeah.
Well,
the whole purpose of the Green New Deal and the smart grid is to stop pumping carbon into the atmosphere.
Right.
That's the reason why we need it.
Yes.
The fact that it would create a lot of jobs is a good byproduct.
Well,
but the real reason why we need it is to keep the planet good. The environment doesn't really care one way or another what we do to it. The Earth will endure no matter what. But the question is whether it'll be habitable for human beings.
Right.
So that's what the whole battle's about. And the fact is that sooner or later we're going to have to deal with it. Some people, and it's like everything else, there's three ways of doing things: the right way, the wrong way, and the army way.
Yeah.
There's one, T. Boone Pickens has one way he wants to make Texas the Saudi Arabia of wind power. So I agree there's a sector of capital, even a small sector of finance capital now, that's interested in investing in green energy. The majority are still tied up with thinking that everything's in coal and petroleum and so on, but there is a faction that's interested in green energy, and the fact is that it will be increasingly so, because more and more people will eventually come to the point, even at the top, that it's necessary.
Well, we have
to change our ways.
Hold on a second, Carl. Yeah.
I would simply like to say, since we're on this topic, and we're a long way from Mr. Trump, but I would like to say, if we are really interested in using green energy, if you look at the demand centers in the United States, and that's basically, where the population is located, the majority of the country is located along both coasts. There are islands in the middle, Chicago and St. Louis and, big cities in between, but in terms of the majority of the American population, they're on the coasts. So T. Boone Pickens can, excuse me, I can say this now, can blow me, so to speak, because if you really want to use...
Internet radio.
If you really want to use wind power, the best wind resources in the United States are actually off both coasts.
Well,
and,
that's true.
And there you are talking about generating the electricity as close to the demand centers as possible, which is the most efficient. It lowers the cost of actually harnessing it. It serves the most people. Doing something like pursuing, you know, having a wind belt through the middle of the country.
Right.
That's a perfect example of what I was talking about with big wind. They see the opportunity to continue the same kind of power structure, and I mean human power, political power structure, lobbying power structure, things like that.
Sure.
By putting it in the center of the country,
yeah,
and shipping it out. And if you talk to an electrical engineer, you'd discover that that's hooey too, because electricity does not ship well.
Loses. There's a resistance issue.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, let me. I think we need to bring this to a close today. I just want to
let's go back to Trump.
No, I want to reprise what we're at. Carl Davidson, a longtime friend of mine, and also a leader of the Committees of Correspondence for Democracy and Socialism, and widely read author, and Patience Waite here also our eternal co-host on the Occupy show, and you know, and myself, John Case. And this is, we've been discussing the threat of fascism and headed off into other topics related to the environment today. So we're going to podcast this one today, Carl. All right, I'll send you the link if you guys want to use it and everything.
Terrific.
I'll publish it. So I think it's great that you called in. I'm happy with the audio quality. It's gotten much better here. It's actually better than it was the last time you called in over at WSHC, because I remember our phone system over there just never seemed to
function
properly. Connect to the outside world very well. Right, W. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you, Carl. By the way, one thing about the wind tunnel in the middle of the Midwest. When I first went to Kansas, and talked to my grandfather, who was raised in Abilene there, I asked him why it was, because I was attending the University of Kansas, and I asked him why it was that there seemed to be, you know, excessive number of crazy people in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And cause to me, it appeared that way, coming from Virginia. And he told me, he says, well, there's nothing between here and the North Pole but a barbed wire fence.
I heard the same story when I was in Nebraska.
There you go.
Between us and the North Pole, but 1,000 miles of prairie.
That's right. All right, buddy. Thank you so much for calling in, and we'll get this published up no later than tomorrow morning. Okay, man.
All right.
All right. Take care. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. All right. Hey,
this was an interesting conversation, because I actually last week on Friday.